This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's something like 100 million bikes produced annually. If we got even a fraction of those made out of bamboo, it would make a significant dent in the amount of carbon that we're putting in the environment. And possibly, if more bamboo is being grown, it could be absorbing more carbon. So it is a real win to change it to something like this.
I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Perhaps Walt Whitman had this week's guests on Sea Change Radio in mind when he wrote those words, as we talk to two entrepreneurs who, in very different ways, are using nature's bounty for innovative purposes. First, we speak to Hawaiian-based bicycle maker Barrett Work, who uses bamboo, the strongest grass around, to make his bike frames. Then we revisit my discussion with Bay Area-based sea forager extraordinaire Kirk Lombard. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Barrett Work. He is the founder of Work Arts, and he makes bamboo bikes. Barrett, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you make some beautiful custom-built bikes in Hawaii. Why don't you explain the difference between your bikes and a regular mass-produced bike? First of all, the materials that you use really shout out. Why don't you explain why you work with bamboo?
Yeah, so the frames are made out of bamboo, and they're joined with both carbon fiber, and I also use natural fibers like linen or hemp, and I'm experimenting with some local fibers from Hawaii, but yeah, it's basically a composite joinery, similar to any kind of carbon fiber or fiberglass joinery, and the bamboo is very light, like aluminum or carbon fiber. It's also super stiff, and it makes for a really comfortable ride. It's naturally shock-absorbing, but also very stiff, so it makes a great material, and it looks beautiful. The tubes are much fatter than you'd find on a normal bike, and that sets it apart, and you can tell it's a little different.
Almost like an older Cannondale aluminum bike in terms of its width, right?
Exactly. That was an inspiration, too, and I had a Cannondale when I was a kid, and I always loved that style. Actually, when I was first prototyping, I was having a problem with the frames were too flexible, and I was using too small of a diameter bamboo, and I was remembering back on my Cannondale and how they were using that thin-walled aluminum, and with the larger diameter tubes, they were able to stiffen up the ride, and that's exactly how it worked out with my designs as well.
And did you originally start building bikes that were traditional metal frames, or have you always been a bamboo bike maker?
Yeah, I never built frames out of steel or any other metal material, but I've been fanatical about bikes for a long time. I mean, I was a bike mechanic a long time ago and was racing mountain bikes back when the sport was just getting started back in the Bay Area. And biking's been a passion, so I wasn't fully focused on bikes at the time that the bike idea was born. I was deep into my passion of woodworking, and well, there is a passion before that blended into this, which was I was working on organic farms on the Big Island. Everybody's trying to use local resources. They're growing bamboo, they're growing coffee, avocados, and trying to figure out ways to use what grows easily here, what's abundant. And well, bamboo grows super easy. It's abundant, but there was always this, well, everybody wanted to plant a lot of it, but nobody really had a great idea what to do with it because it takes a lot of skill to make something of value. So this has been brewing in my mind for, since I came to Hawaii 15 years ago, and finally through the practice of woodworking and all that other skills blended in, I figured out ways to join the bamboo in a super strong way, in a way that's as strong, if not stronger, than the metal frames.
Yeah, I see you sell custom-made furniture as well. So were you doing the furniture before you entered the bike
world?
Yeah, exactly. I've been doing furniture for many years, and like that's how I got my start in the woodworking, was building custom furniture on the Big Island.
It's beautiful stuff.
Oh, thank you.
And I see there's bamboo in some of the products, but far from exclusive bamboo.
Yeah, I think that's one of the mistakes that gets made with bamboo. When you see bamboo furniture, there's a kind of an idea that it's weak, it's cheap, it falls apart. It seems that a lot of times the approach with building bamboo furniture is to use nothing but bamboo, but that's not really the way to take use of bamboo's super strengths. It has strengths in certain ways and certain directions, but it's not good in every possible way. So if you can integrate it into like a table leg or a stool leg, it's super strong like that. But if you try to make a tabletop, you have to glue a million pieces together to make a flat surface. It's not really the most appropriate use. So instead of like hanging on to this idea that it has to be 100% bamboo, I just let go of that. It doesn't have to be pure bamboo. Like, we can still use local woods. We have a lot of an abundance of many beautiful woods here. So incorporating like monkey pod or silky oak is another beautiful and invasive species, and just integrating that in and creating something beautiful was the idea. Like, making use of our invasive species and abundant species rather than focusing on the stuff that's in short supply, like koa. I mean, everybody's crazy about koa and it's beautiful. I love the stuff, but we don't need to chop down the entire forest to have beautiful furniture. We can still make use of these alternative woods and still have something really amazing. So that's the root of how it came into being.
So walk us through your process of building a bamboo frame, if you can. Like, how do you keep it from getting damaged by weather? How do you keep it from splintering? And how do you select your wood, etc.?
Yeah, I take it from the very start. I mean, we have several bamboo patches to harvest from here on Oahu, and like, I'm going for the invasive species. So we have thousands of acres. I get a permit from the forestry department. I go out and I select. And this is the most important part, is when you're selecting the bamboo, because when I first started, I just went out and looked for the biggest and nicest looking bamboo. But what happens when you do that is you end up harvesting immature bamboo, and it splits and it cracks, and you'd be like, oh, this is a junk material. But after some experimenting, I figured out, all right, you're looking for a certain age bamboo. You want ones that are, totally mature, and it's got the most dense fibers. It's got the least amount of starch in it that the bugs are going to eat. So I'm going in there looking for these grandpa poles, but not too old, because too old, then they start to degrade in the forest. So selection is number one, and that's where, you know, most people go wrong. And then, so I've got my bamboo, and then I air dry it for 6 to 9 months, and I don't accelerate the drying. It has to be dried slowly, otherwise it's going to crack at the ends and also damage your material. So there's that. And also, I treat the material with, it's a non-toxic to humans, it's a borate and borax solution, so that keeps out any insects, because that's a big problem. Generally with a mature bamboo, you don't have bug problems, but if you're building like a high-end bike, you don't want to have a customer come back and be like, you know what, I got bugs running all over my frame and turning into powders.
So that can happen, huh?
That could happen if you don't treat your bamboo, yeah. And especially in Hawaii, we've got plenty of bugs. So I'm not taking any chances there. I treat it, and I haven't had any bug problems since. I mean, ideally, I would like to not treat it, but it's the best of what we can do environmentally. So it's a compromise, but it's definitely worth it. So from there, we've got a good bamboo products to start building the bike with, and then it's get the poles cut rough to size to the frame to go into a jig that roughly looks like the frame that you're going to be making. And then I scrape off the natural outer layer of bamboo. A bamboo has this really hard coating on the outside. It's harder than any kind of paint. It's got this high silica content in there. It's so hard that you can't really sand it off. It kills sandpaper. It's like harder than the material they make sandpaper with. So you could sand one pole with like one sheet of sandpaper, and then you gotta get another sheet of sandpaper. So it has to be scraped off with this cabinet scraper, metal scraper. And you know, I found efficient ways to do this, but that's really important to get that off, because if you don't, and you take your bike, say, from a humid place like Hawaii, and you take it, actually we were recently in Salt Lake City in the winter, and it's just so dry, and if you don't have your poles coated and sealed with a different finish, it just the humidity change just shocks it and the pole is split. So the natural finish is too breathable, so I coat it with an epoxy and a spar urethane, so it's UV protected and will preserve it for decades once the bike's finished.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Barrett Work. He is the founder of Work Arts and makes custom-made bamboo bicycles. So Barrett, just looking at your website, I see that most of your bikes are hardtail. They're not suspension bikes. Is that because you're trying to save weight on the bike, or does bamboo not lend itself well to a suspension bicycle?
It would be possible to do a suspension bike, but my focus right now is not on that market. There's so many great ways to make a bamboo bike that don't require such a complicated design. So, it's starting from the simplest design and getting more complicated. So the first designs have been single speed, no gears, no derailleurs, just a really clean chain line. Doesn't need any cable routing.
Fixies, huh?
Basically a fixie, yeah, or like a cruiser. So that's the simplest design. And that's a design that I teach students, because I also teach workshops for people to build their own frames here in Honolulu over a weekend or 3 days, something like that. And then next complicated, we started adding derailleurs and disc brakes. And with each complication like that, it adds a bit more time. And so suspension's not impossible, but what's been the biggest interest in the bamboo bike is people coming to do these workshops. So I'm teaching at the Honolulu Museum of Art, and people are just so excited. I mean, they're building their own frame. They're going to be riding a bike that they built themselves. And I can't make it so complicated we're going to build suspension, because it just wouldn't be doable. But they come out of there and they're riding, you know, they're either riding like a fixie, or they're riding, like one guy built an internal 8-speed or internal gear hub bike, so it's got all the gears are in the hub, but it still looks like a single speed, and it still has caliper brakes and all the bells and whistles like that. But we're still trying to keep it simple so it can be done in a reasonable amount of time and reasonable cost too. So that's the main market right now.
Yes. How much do your bikes cost? Give us an idea of the range.
Well, for those workshops, they run about $600 for the basic frames. If you'd like a custom frame built by me, they start at $1,800, and then complete bikes run from $2,500, $3,000 in that neighborhood.
And how many bikes do you estimate you've produced?
We're at 30 now.
And what kind of weight are we looking at compared to some of the alloy frames and carbon and titanium frames that we see in the high-end bike market in a similar price range to what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing about bamboos. It's very light and it's very strong. So it's right up there with the weight of a lightweight aluminum or titanium frame. It's definitely lighter than any steel frame. It's lighter than most aluminum frames. I don't really like to talk about the weight of a complete bike, because you can spend a fortune on components to save a gram here and a gram there. What it really comes down to have a real fair comparison, you got to talk about the frame weight. So the frames weigh typically for a lightweight aluminum frame around 3.5 pounds, 4 pounds. So the bamboo frames come in about 3.5 pounds. For a student bike, they're around 4.5, 5 pounds, because I don't want to take any chances going super lightweight on the joinery. But for the bikes that I build, I really engineer them for lightweight and strength. So the only lighter option than bamboo would be a carbon frame, fully carbon frame, but that bike's made completely out of epoxy and carbon fiber, so environmentally it's not the best choice, but bamboo is a clear environmental choice over steel or carbon. So.
Yeah, speaking of carbon, what kind of carbon footprint does a carbon frame bike have, or a steel frame bike, compared to the bamboo bike frame? Obviously, you can't do all the numbers, but if you have any idea of what goes into forging the steel of the bikes that we ride generally compared to what you have.
Well, the little bit of research I've done, a steel bike produces something like 5 kilograms of carbon just for producing the metals. So right off of that, we don't have that, because the bamboo grows. It's actually absorbing carbon to grow, and it's just cut. There's no heat needed to process it. You have the material for a negative carbon impact. So, I mean, if you were to, there's just something like 100 million bikes produced annually. If we got even a fraction of those made out of bamboo, it would make a significant dent in the amount of carbon that we're putting in the environment. And possibly, if more bamboo is being grown, it could be absorbing more carbon. So it is a real win to change it to something like this.
So do you know of any other bike makers who work with bamboo?
Yeah, there's a handful of bamboo bike makers around the world. There's even one in Iran who has, I've seen him on Instagram. It's pretty cool. There's one that's more established in Ghana. They're making bikes more on a production scale, and then a lot of those bikes get sent to, I believe, Germany or throughout Europe, and so they're able to sell the bike for a good value in Europe, and that money goes a long way in Africa, making a good community. And then there's in China, there is a bamboo bike maker in Vietnam, and there's a couple more in the United States as well. So it's a very small industry, but it is growing for sure. Oh, in Mexico too. That seems like they're doing quite a bit down there too.
The website is workarts.com. That's W-E-R-K arts.com. Ferret Work, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thank you, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kirk Lombard. He is the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company. Kirk, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
So for our listeners, why don't you first explain how Sea Forager works?
Okay, well, it operates along the lines of sort of like a produce box, CSA delivery. People sign up online for a minimum of, I think, 4 deliveries. They pay a set rate. And then I choose based on what I think is most sustainable option plus what's the freshest. So, and then I provide that seafood. I deliver to various drop locations and also door-to-door service. If it's requested, if it's in San Francisco, we can do that. So
what gave you the idea for this? Are there other
CSFs
around the country that do this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, I think, a growing trend, happily. There's a few other competitors in the Bay Area. But when you look at how many different seafood companies there are, I mean, there are dozens in California. There are way fewer people who define themselves as CSFs or fish delivery packages, and so there's less competition, which is one of the reasons that I was interested in doing it, just on a business level. The way Sea Forager started is that I do walking tours where I, they're very fishy, sort of fish-centric, seafoody, salty walking tours. I take people around various neighborhoods and on the coastline, and I teach them about the seaweeds that grow there and the monkey face eels that live under the rocks. And we practice how to cast, how to throw casting nets so people can catch their own small fish using the Hawaiian casting net technique. And I demystify that because there's a lot of different people who teach how to do that online. And I have the simplest way to do it and the most effective. So I teach people how to go out and get stuff. And I was doing these tours for a couple of years, and I just started to notice that at the end of the tour, I'd get a lot of people who would ask me, they'd say, hey, so if I can't go out and throw a casting net and catch my own herring, or I don't have the time to go out and catch a perch on the coastline here or go fishing for stripers or whatever, how do I get something that I know is fresh and sustainable? So I was pointing them in various directions and just throwing a lot of business at various other, well, really there was only one or two different companies that I was really throwing people towards. And I just decided, well, since they're asking that question, why don't I provide the seafood? And with the contacts that I've made in the seafood world over the last 20 years, I've been able to do that. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
Take us back to that 20-year period a little bit. Give us a little bit of background. You have a very interesting past.
That's it's a hard one because I've worn a lot of different hats. So we'll just... I've done a lot of different jobs over the years, and but the one thing that I always have done is I've always fished, mostly recreationally, and I've always just been in love with being out on the water and or just along the shoreline, as it were. Most of the fishing that I actually do is shore-based, so like the things that I write about in my book the most are things like monkey face eels and night smelt and surf smelt and fishing from some of the piers in the Bay Area. And that's always been sort of my, you know, my focus. As many different jobs and careers as I had over the years, the one thing that I always have done is been connected to the ocean in some way or another. And so I just decided at a certain point to commit to a life in seafood. I'm a true seafooditarian in the old Mr. Flood. That I'm making an obscure reference to a book by Joseph Mitchell, who has a wonderful, wonderful take on American seafood in the 1930s. You can read about it in a book called Up in the Old Hotel, but he has a piece called Old Mr. Flood, which describes a person who's just passionate about seafood. And old Mr. Flood refers to himself as a seafooditarian. And so that's how I refer to myself.
And what is the problem with being a seafooditarian in today's marketplace if you're not a conscious consumer in terms of what you're putting in your body and what you're doing in terms of supporting some of these less sustainable businesses? Why don't you explain how your business is kind of a reaction to some of the market inequities and inefficiencies?
If you don't have a conscience, then you don't have a problem. You know, you can go do anything. But if you do have a conscience, and you know you're concerned about the plight of the oceans and the seafood resources, you know, there's some very practical things that you can do.
So, what is the flip side of your business? You people who actually are conscious about seafood are your consumers, but 99% of people don't even think about where their seafood comes from. Why should they?
One thing I've just always not ever felt like it's productive to tell people what they should do. So I do what I do. And if that appeals to people, hey, I'm more than happy to provide seafood. And what I do is I always have the name of the boat. I know when the fish was landed. I give details to my customers about how those fish were landed. I'm into the story. I'm into people knowing that what we provide on a weekly basis depends on a lot of factors. It depends on the skill of the guy going out and getting those fish. It depends on how big the swell is. It depends on what is migrating and what is available and what quotas have been reached. All of that stuff, if you're not attuned to that, then you come to think that it's just always there. And the problematic seafood, as I see it, is the stuff that's just always there. So a major component of what we do is to educate. And, you know, people don't sign up for Sea Forager unless they're open to that. You know, I every now and then I get somebody who writes me an email saying, hey, you know, I could have gotten such and such a fish for half of what you're charging. And then I say, well, first of all, how do you know that such and such a fish is even the species that you're buying? The New York Times did a study. What was it? It was either 40 or 60% of all American seafood is mislabeled to the species level. That is just insane. So you're buying tuna. How the hell do you know what you're getting? Anyway, so I let alone how it was caught, when it was caught, where it was caught, who caught it, how they were treated, how much they were paid for that. I mean, all of that stuff. Once that becomes a mystery, then it's just there's openings for, you know, the miserable treatment of the ocean and the fisheries. I try to take that mystery out.
And the people who are part of that as well are down the whole supply chain. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of misery there as well. We've chronicled some of the work in Southeast Asia.
Oh, man. Have you ever seen on one of my tours or at one of my talks, I met a guy who was working on a film. It was called, it's a really darkly humorous title. It was called Grinding Nemo.
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. So if you're having a really bad day, do not go and see this movie. If you're having a really good day and you just think that you're flying too high and you want to bring yourself down a couple of notches, go watch Grinding Nemo, which is all about the shrimp industry, I guess, in, I don't want to say the wrong country, I think it was Indonesia or something, and how they've depopulated the coastal resource to the extent that the only fish left to feed the shrimp in the coastal destroying shrimp farms that are being built, the only fish left are the clownfish, like Nemo. So they put these drag boats that drag over the tops of these coral reefs and destroy the reefs, and then they catch these little tiny fish, and then they grind them into fish meal to feed the shrimp that are in the shrimp ponds that are destroying the coastal ecosystem. So and they're employing slave labor to do this. Now you don't need to watch the movie, but you should check it out anyway, because it will really impress you.
He's the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company, Kirk Lombard. Kirk, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Galactic, the Jerry Garcia Band, and John Scholey. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.